This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last year began with women's marches across the country in response to Donald Trump's inauguration. Those marches are about to take place again, and we'll hear about them later in the hour. 2017 ended with the exploding Me Too movement, which shows no signs of letting up. Me Too came about in part as a response to a New York Times story about sexual harassment on the part of one of the most powerful men in Hollywood, Harvey Weinstein. The movement has had a seismic impact on the entertainment and media industries and continues to reverberate. To help guide its coverage of this ongoing story and the growing power and influence of women, The Times created the position of gender editor, a first-of-its-kind job at the paper and one held by our first guest this hour, Jessica Bennett. She's also the author of Feminist Fight Club, a survival manual for a sexist workplace, and writes the Me Too Moment newsletter for The Times. She joins us by phone from her desk at the New York Times in Manhattan. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
You are, as I said, the first ever gender editor for The Times and probably for any newspaper in the entire world. What is your role? What does the gender editor do?
A lot of things, but essentially my goal is to better engage women readers around the world. And so what that means is doing that through journalism, through extensive coverage. It also means thinking about new platforms, thinking about ways women consume that may be differently from men. And, of course, in this particular moment, guiding and steering a lot of the sexual harassment coverage that we're continuing to do.
What are you finding about, because newspapers have been traditionally written, published, edited by men, and if I'm not mistaken, the vast majority of readers have usually been men, although I'm sure that is changing. What is the difference in the way women view the world, write about it, read about it?
Well, you know, I think that quite naturally, if you have a product that, you know, since its existence has been created essentially by and for white men, it speaks in a way that is inherently male, which is not to say that women cannot consume it. But we've heard feedback from readers that, you know, the Times does seem very male. When they think of the New York Times, they often think of it as a man. And so we have plenty of wonderful, impressive female reporters here doing amazing investigative work, and in fact have launched this current moment and this Me Too moment that we're in. So some of this is putting them out forward. Some of this is doing research into what our readers want. Some of it is just simply doing the things we've long done, you know, rigorous coverage of topics like business and sports and international affairs, but incorporating a gender lens into that. So it's not that we're going to have a separate section. We're not trying to recreate the women's pages of the 1950s. This is simply thinking about ways that we can incorporate gender into the coverage we already do.
Are the guys who run the place having a lot of aha moments as a result of this, where they slap themselves off the side of the head because they never realized how male-centric they were and you bring it to their attention?
No, I think that they did realize we're dealing with a very woke bunch here. But certainly I think all of us could do by reminding ourselves at some times that, you know, there is an engagement gap when it comes to readership across all media. It tends to be that men have historically been the ones doing the journalism. And so not only do we want to correct for that, but we want to keep doing innovative journalism that expands on some of these themes, like gender issues, like sexual harassment, like women in power, also race and sexuality and gender identity, some of these newer themes, and continue to bring readers into them.
I made an assumption at the beginning of this that you were the first ever, you are the first ever gender editor, but you may be the only one in the world. Is that the case, or have other newspapers and media outlets taken note of this and found people like you to fill a similar role at their workplace?
You know, I'm not sure. I know that I'm the first gender editor here, and there are a variety of publications that have approached this in different ways. You know, I think the realization is that no business in this day and age can thrive without engaging women. They're, in this country, 51% of the population. Globally, they hold trillions of dollars in consumer spending power. Like, simply, it's a business decision in many ways. But I think that places have approached that in different ways. Some have specifically gone after women readers by creating women-focused products. And I think that's a completely valid approach. We decided not to do that. We wanted to incorporate this coverage into what we already do, into the larger report.
You were the selection of the Times in a field of 300 applicants. They chose you. Does that put a lot of pressure on you to properly shape this conversation or guide this conversation to make sure that multiple voices are heard? I mean, you go to work every day carrying that weight around with you.
You know, I think it's sort of like any other job. I want to do my best. I've been covering these issues for a long time. This is very important to me. I care a lot about it. And quite honestly, there couldn't be a better time to be taking on this role. We recently got something like 13,000 candidates for a travel position, a staff writer that will travel around the globe for one of our travel features. So compared to that, it's actually nothing.
I was going to ask you if that job's still open.
Unfortunately, no. I kind of want it.
You wrote your book, The Feminist Fight Club, a survival manual for a sexist workplace, before a lot of people had even heard of the Me Too movement, and perhaps before it even started. And that movement, of course, let people in on a dirty little secret that a lot of women already knew because they experienced it. Your book's been published in 7 languages. It's become a podcast. It's been adapted for TV, or it's being adapted for TV. Given that the column you write, the strength and impact of the Me Too movement and the women's marches, which we'll talk about later in this program, how did we reach suddenly, it seems like all of a sudden in the last 365 days, we reached this watershed moment?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. My book came out in 2016, before the election, when I, like a lot of people, incorrectly thought that we were going to have a female president. And so it simultaneously feels more relevant and more outdated now than ever. And a lot of things in the book have had to be updated. But, you know, I think this is a long time coming. This Me Too moment or movement is a culmination of what women have been saying quietly behind closed doors through whispered networks to each other for years and years and years. And suddenly, there were women willing to speak up and break through. They happened to be very famous women, and it galvanized a movement. You know, this is something that the creator of the Me Too hashtag, a woman named Tarana Burke, an activist, had been talking about for years, but it didn't really catch on until now. And so I think that that's a combination of where we are in this moment in time politically. I think it's a combination of the way that the women's marches did galvanize women. I think it's the product of social media being able to elevate these voices and elevate voices that didn't traditionally have access to mainstream media. And so I think it's just sort of exploded from there with a lot of historical forces playing into it.
Because it didn't happen during Anita Hill's testimony before Congress about Clarence Thomas. It didn't happen with Paula Jones. It didn't happen with Monica Lewinsky. It's happening now. Is social media the biggest force here, you think?
It's a very big one. You know, it's fascinating. I was looking back at the Anita Hill case, or the Clarence Thomas case, perhaps I should refer to it as. And, you know, after that happened, people were, of course, talking about it. There were slogans and buttons that said, "I believe Anita." Complaints to the EEOC, the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, went up 73% in the year after. So it did feel, I think, at that moment, and I was too young to remember it, but I've talked to a lot of people about this now, that something was going to change. But then it didn't. You know, he got confirmed. Anita Hill kind of went quietly away for some time, and women stopped talking about it. It sort of showed women, I think, that what Anita Hill went through in the questioning and the way that she was portrayed is what any woman who dared to speak out would have to endure.
And yeah, I think Go ahead.
I think what's changed now is that no one woman feels like they have to bear the burden of speaking up. There is this army of women behind them and an equally extensive army using a hashtag on the internet.
Yeah, she became the bad guy during no one believed her, or the men, particularly in Congress, didn't want to believe her or chose not to believe her or tried to paint her with very broad brushes that were not very flattering. Things have changed. However, let me flip this coin on its side. Some people look at what's happened as a result of the Me Too movement, and they see that they view it with some suspicion or some fear. A lot of people have been accused, and a lot of people have suffered severe consequences as though they have been proven guilty, yet they did not have access to due process. A lot of these people are absolutely guilty. But some of them may or may not be. So do you believe that everyone who has been accused is guilty?
I think that there is a shift in the conversation happening right now to really looking at the nuances of, does the punishment fit the crime? And in some cases, not crime in some of these cases, in some cases, accusations. And I'm happy to see that we're having a more robust conversation about that, because it's incredibly important. And if you care about women being comfortable speaking up and change happening, we have to have due process. That simply is a tenet of what we stand for in this country. So I think that people are having that conversation. I was just speaking with a legal scholar who was telling me that in some academic circles, there's conversations about, well, should there be a new term created? You know, we have manslaughter in the legal world when dealing with death. Should we have something, maybe rape slaughter is not the right word, that sounds very crass, but some sort of term that applies to some of these accusations that don't amount to sexual assault in the eyes of the law.
The other thing that we've seen movie stars plummet and directors plummet, producers' careers ended. We've seen a U.S. senator resign, a member of the House has resigned. Yesterday, a local eye doctor accused of sexual misconduct turned his license into practice and declared bankruptcy here in Charlotte. Is the ending of a career always the proper end result of these accusations?
Organizations are really grappling with that. You know, not all of these accusations are the same. There is a very big difference between Harvey Weinstein and a lot of these other cases. And yet, so far, there seems to be one major punishment. You lose your job and you lose your career. I think it will be interesting to watch how the rehabilitation process goes. You know, what happens to some of these people? Is their career ruined or can they come back? You know, Louis C.K. has kind of quietly now gone away, said he's gone into rehab or whatever. But will he come back? Will he be able to come back? So I'm watching that very closely. I'm very interested in it. I think there is also a real robust conversation being had about levels of punishment and how we can ensure that there is not simply one punishment for every single crime.
I would imagine that most people would agree, and women, I don't want to put women's words in women's mouths, but I would think that they would want the punishment to fit whatever the aggression was. And I don't want to call it a crime because it may not be a crime, but
right.
There are various levels of this aggression, and some of them are more egregious than others. So you're saying that they might, at some future point when the pendulum begins to swing and the heat's turned down a bit, be open to some other form of discretionary punishment.
I think we're probably already seeing that happening in some organizations. You know, we're only hearing about these very public cases, and probably in those instances, organizations feel a lot of public pressure to do something rash or to come up with a very severe punishment. But I think that a lot of organizations are probably dealing with these things quietly and perhaps not simply going with the cutting off of at the knees approach. You know, there is a spectrum to this behavior. I think that part of what we're seeing with so many people coming forward and so many men falling is just how widespread this problem was, just how long it was kept quiet, just how uncomfortable women were speaking up about it. But I also think we're seeing a lot of conversation about exactly how we deal with this. And frankly, our culture is not necessarily prepared. We don't really have institutions in place to deal with a lot of this behavior.
Let me stop you because we have to take a break, Jessica. We'll come back with more with Jessica Bennett in just a moment at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins talking to Jessica Bennett, the gender editor for the New York Times and the author of Feminist Fight Club, a survival manual for a sexist workplace, about the Me Too movement and other things. A lot of the results that we've seen come out of the Me Too movement have dealt with very famous people on both sides, accusers and people supporting accusers and the people who are being accused. Is anything similar to that happening in places that are not quite as public or not quite as visible?
I think we're having a lot of conversations behind closed doors still, and I think they need to come to the surface.
because a lot of these women in Hollywood now, the Time's Up campaign formed to provide $14 million in legal defense funds for working class women. Mm-hmm. Is that the next wave? Has any of that money been put to work, or do you know?
I'm not sure how or if it's been put to work yet, but I know that it is being donated to the National Women's Law Center, which has been around for a long time. And so I saw that as a really positive sign of, you know, taking this very palpable celebrity power, this star power, and putting it into action. Because, yes, you know, wearing a black dress on the red carpet is one thing, but putting millions of dollars into a legal defense fund for working class women who don't have the same access is an entirely another one, and I think very encouraging.
We're going to talk in a few minutes about the march on Washington in the last year and the one coming up in Charlotte this year, but that march was precipitated by the election of Donald Trump, and there are many reasons that Donald Trump was elected president of the United States, and well, much of that was in reaction to President Obama being the first African-American president and some other things going on in society. But at the same time, we've seen the rise in the power of women and influence of women, and women not taking it anymore, not sitting down and taking it anymore. We've seen gay people living and working openly in society, demanding their rights, including the right to marry. Transgender people have come out of the shadows. We've witnessed the Black Lives Matter movement taking place. All these things, are these all parts of a whole that is simply changing? Is this a genie that cannot be put back into the bottle?
I mean, I think so. I think that, you know, this past year has exposed a lot of things that have been simmering underneath the surface for a really long time, and also some things that we have known about and haven't properly grappled with. And so I don't know if you can put that back in, and frankly, I don't think we should.
So what are you hearing from your readers? I know you have to go, but what are you hearing from your readers about your impact on the coverage that they're seeing in the Times and the newsletter that you've written, that you write for the Times, et cetera?
You know, it's actually been fascinating. So I'm one person, and I'm pretty new here. I'm still trying to get the lay of the land, and I'm getting literally thousands of emails every week from people with all sorts of opinions. You know, there are people who disagree with the movement. There are many who have very nuanced takes on what could be an effective way to stop it. I've talked to some about bystander intervention, which is one of the few really proven things that works when it comes to sexual harassment at work. But by and large, what I am hearing is just stories, story after story after story from women and men, too, who've experienced some kind of abuse at work, who have never told anyone about it, who may not be contacting me because they want me to write about it. They simply want a place to share this. And for so long, I think so much of this has been buried. And so one of the biggest things and the most powerful things I think about this movement is that it has allowed people to speak up, oftentimes for the first time.
And is there a running theme through most of these people's stories that they share with you?
You know, it's a power differential. A lot of it has to do with power. People who are in positions where they didn't feel like they could speak up, where they felt like they had to take it because this person held their job in their hands. And in many cases, not people with economic or media power to, you know, expose the behavior. So people that really have not spoken out about it. And I think it's really important. I think that one way this coverage is now shifting, and I'm happy to see it, is that we are focusing less on the celebrities and more on regular women who endure this every day. And I think that is important.
Jessica Bennett is the gender editor, the first ever gender editor of the New York Times, the writer of their Me Too Moment newsletter, and the author of Feminist Fight Club, a survival manual for a sexist workplace. I wish I had more time with you. I'd ask you if that came out of your personal experience, but I know you have to run off to a meeting. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You're very welcome.